What do you like, I guess, about Serge's fit with the Clippers and kind of reuniting with his pal Kawhi after their championship time together here in Toronto?
Well, that's one of the things. So the other thing is the Clippers needed to pivot pretty quickly after losing Montrezl Harrell the previous night to the Lakers. And look, in fairness to the Clippers, you know, there were some mixed feelings on whether they wanted to keep him or not. He is a good player, but he also has some defensive shortcomings. And so I think relative to that, Serge Ibaka is actually an upgrade because he's a much more dependable defender. Now, they might lose some instant scoring that Montrezl Harrell provided off the bench, and it's certainly not a good thing, you know, for them that, you know, their LA rival with the Lakers got him, because now that championship team's even more dangerous. But when you're looking at it specifically through the lens of, are they a better team with having Serge Ibaka as opposed to Montrezl Harrell, I would argue that Serge is the better option.
Agreed. And I guess it's an interesting thought that, you know, as much as his on-court value, you know, provides, it's obvious, the off-the-court stuff seems important too, because it became no secret that, you know, especially Harrell, you know, wasn't too shy about voicing his opinions during the season about where things stood on the culture there, and they clearly had some issues in the playoffs. Just bringing in somebody like Serge, who's clearly very popular wherever he goes, that's got to be something to be seen as a positive for the Clippers.
Yeah, I mean, from my understanding, he obviously would know more. That he has a good relationship with Kawhi Leonard. Now, I would push back a little bit. I don't blame Montrezl Harrell for having some of the issues that the Clippers had in terms of the philosophical differences with, you know, load managing Kawhi and Paul George, where the rest of the team weren't used to that program. I think when you're going to assign blame for this Clippers team, I don't think that there were personalities clashes or ego clashes, but there was a struggle with how to get this going, and especially because they already had another new piece with Paul George. This idea of prioritizing health over chemistry the entire season wasn't necessarily wrong. It was the right philosophy, but it seemed that the more and more time progressed, that the Clippers were moving in full extremes. I think that there was a way to prioritize health but still have more on-court chemistry time and have guys practice more consistently, because the reality was there was maybe one or two times that the team itself, you know, practiced as an entire team. And, you know, when they were a fully healthy roster, they were fine. But I think that they were vulnerable when adversity struck, particularly in the starting lineup or particularly in the bubble, because they didn't have that same level of cohesion as maybe the Lakers did, where they had a lot of more on-court practice time together.
Looking at the moves that, you know, they've made so far in terms of losing Harrell, bringing in Ibaka, and also losing Shamet, but bringing in Kennard, stacked up with what the Lakers have done, you know, re-signing KCP, bringing in Harrell, Wes Matthews, you know, and sure more to come with veteran minimums. Do you think that they've closed whatever gap exists between them, or do you still look at the Lakers as, you know, considerably a superior team and a superior roster?
I think the Lakers widened the gap. Look, like, not all these every player has its pluses and minuses, where if you're looking at the Lakers specifically, they lost some defense with Dwight Howard and Rajon Rondo and Danny Green. But the upgrade is that they got younger with all their moves, and they got a lot more consistent offensive scoring punch. And so I think when you're looking at this, you have two things. You're going to be able to relieve the offensive burden on LeBron and Anthony Davis, particularly to open the season when maybe, you know, they're dealing with such a short turnaround from when the season ended. And you're also going to much more likely have a healthier roster throughout the year. Even though it worked out in the Lakers' favor last year, you know, Rajon Rondo had a lot of injury issues, and Dwight, you know, he was valuable in certain series, but he wasn't valuable in other series, because that's just how the modern NBA works, where you don't need a traditional big man as much as you used to. And so I think when you look at it through those lens, the Lakers' gap is even wider. They've become even a much better team with the free agency moves than they were last week.
Yeah, it's hard not to like what they've done. And I feel like, as much as anything, the moves, like we were talking about the condensed schedule and how tricky it's going to be this year and how teams are going to approach it, you know, those moves, like maybe Montrezl Harrell isn't a crucial piece come playoff time, but, you know, players like him and Schroeder, players who can kind of carry an offensive burden if LeBron is either sitting or just not playing as much, you know, well, I got to assume help cushion the blow and not see the Lakers, you know, drop games the same way they probably would have this past year if one of, or maybe even both of LeBron or AD ended up sitting.
Yeah, and to tie this up into a bow, I think Montrez is a better fit for the Lakers than he is for the Clippers. So they're going to be able to accentuate his strengths even more and minimize his weaknesses. And what do I mean by that? Well, there's no question he is a really great pick-and-roll attacker at the basket and can be very physical offensively. He's not a great rim protector, but that doesn't matter as much because they have Anthony Davis there that can take care of that job, where when you're with the Clippers, Ivica Zubac, he's a very young player. He's developing. He's moving in the right direction, but, like, there's no way around it. Even if he is a good defender, it doesn't even match close to what Anthony Davis can provide. So I think all across the board, again, the Lakers checked all the boxes. And, you know, for the Clippers, even though they salvaged some things with getting Serge Ibaka and keeping Marcus Morris, they've also taken a step back because they lost Harrell. They lost Jamichael Green. So this idea that, you know, they're going to be able to improve from last year kind of remains to be seen when you take into account the roster changes and also seeing how Ty Lue will try to manage, you know, this team with the players and personalities compared to how Doc Rivers did.
Mark Medina is with us from USA Today. And, you know, looking at other teams in the West, obviously it's the Clippers and Lakers, and when they make splashy moves, they're going to dominate the headlines. But yeah, you know, Utah has had a very, very interesting offseason. I really did like the Favors pickup, the familiarity there, you know, great depth behind Gobert, and even if they wanted to play those two together. But, you know, I see this Donovan Mitchell extension, and he's a really, really good player. But that seems like quite an investment for somebody who's still, you know, figuring it out, I think, come playoff time. I guess, how do you put into perspective right now everything that Utah's done so far?
I like what Utah's done. You know, I think especially for small market teams, their way toward competing in the NBA is about trying to build off continuity. And they, you know, they're able to get Derek Favors back. They kept Jordan Clarkson. You know, he has warts in his game, but he's also a very dependable scorer and he hustles a lot. And with Donovan Mitchell, yeah, I think for sure that there is an open-ended discussion on what his trajectory is going to be, but clearly, what would be the alternatives for Utah? Yeah. Really nothing. And he is a star player. And I think what they learned with the Gordon Hayward situation a few years back is you do what you can to keep elite talent, even if it's, you know, a debate of does that mean a superstar talent, an all-star talent, because the alternative is he leaves in a few years and you don't get anything in return. And I'm someone who thinks Donovan Mitchell is just scratching the surface, so you know, I applaud the Jazz for being, you know, proactive with that. But even if I had some skepticism, when you're looking at it again, what would the alternative be? It's a no-brainer that they have to extend them, because then it would just be a matter of years where a high-market team could swoop in and take them.
Do you look at Utah's roster right now as, you know, legitimate in terms of putting pressure on the Lakers and Clippers, you know, in the same vein as the Nuggets, or do you still think they need to do more?
You could always do more, but I think that they've done most of their work. You know, I think Denver, they've taken a step back because they lost some key guys like Jeremy Grant and Mason Plumlee, and that's not to say that the Nuggets did anything wrong. They did everything right, but that's just kind of the perils of when you don't have the same amount of resources toward keeping your team, you're vulnerable. Even, you know, losing guys to a team that's not really high profile in the Detroit Pistons. So, you know, does this mean that they can compete with the Lakers and Clippers? Not necessarily, but I think that you always want to be proactive and aggressive, because the alternative is much worse, that you're just toiling in the NBA lottery, number one. But number two, you also have to take into account that in the NBA, anything can happen. You know, unfortunately, for better and for worse, you know, these teams' fortunes rely on health. So there could always be an injury that happens with either team that all of a sudden, you know, the dynamic in the West changes. And, you know, for a team like Utah or a team like Denver or anyone else that's kind of in the middle, you want to be able to ready to strike when that opportunity opens.
So you mentioned Denver, and you know, I guess they lose Grant and they pick up Green. And I honestly, I don't know if I look at that as a huge subtraction. You know, Grant was very good for them, but they, and I guess they bring back Millsap. They needed more of that kind of versatile big type of player, and Green certainly fits the mold while also hurting a team that you beat in the playoffs in the Clippers. Do you like what you've seen so far from Denver?
Yeah, I thought that was a good pickup. You know, I'm mixed on whether, you know, you'd rather have Jeremy Grant or Jermichael Green. I think you can, you know, you can't go wrong with either player, but I was favoring more Jeremy Grant just because one of the Nuggets' calling cards was having continuity, and that would help that. Now, that being said, the Nuggets are still in the mix. As long as you have Jamal Murray and Nikola Jokic, which they do, I mean, those are the main driving force for that team. So I think when you're looking after the Lakers and Clippers, you're going to have this logjam of teams like the Nuggets, the Utah Jazz, the Dallas Mavericks, you know, maybe the Portland Trailblazers, where you could make a case any of those teams could be three, or maybe they're down at six or even below in the West. I mean, that's how competitive the West has become and always has been, but even more so, I think, these last few years.
Mark Medina is with us from USA Today. All right, so let's look at the Eastern Conference a little bit and start, I guess, at the top in terms of the regular season with Milwaukee, who, you know, there's, I guess, they've got Drew Holiday in the fold now, which is certainly a good pickup. You know, that Bobby Portis, Bryn Forbes, Torrey Craig, the Bogdanovich thing fell apart. You know, looking at all of these moves, I guess, how much better suited do you think that this roster is to avoid the issues that have plagued them in the playoffs each of the last 2 years?
I think they're better suited, but obviously the Bogdanovich situation blew up in their face, and that's catastrophic. Now, where do you assign the blame pie for this? It's really too early to read, but I was just scratching my head on how any team could walk away with the impression that a deal was finalized on Monday in a sign-and-trade when free agency doesn't even start until Friday. So, you know, whether it was a team just being naive with that or someone inexplicably leaking that prematurely, like, I don't know who is mostly responsible, but it's inexcusable for any of the teams that are involved because, you know, we all roll our eyes during this time of year when free agency hits and all of a sudden, within minutes, a deal is agreed upon. And obviously that shows that there's back-channel communications well before the official deadline marker. But I think that there's a clear difference between that versus ironing out a deal that somehow becomes public 4 days before free agency even starts. And this idea that, you know, anyone would think, oh, yeah, they agreed to a sign-and-trade. Like, you can't technically agree to sign-and-trades before free agency happens. So I'm still scratching my head and still trying to get answers on how that all happened. But how this pertains to the roster itself, they're in a better position. I think Drew Holiday is a really good defender, but I think the most important thing is how does Giannis feel about this?
Yeah.
And it's not just about does this help him win, but does it make him happy? And no doubt the Bucks did these moves knowing how Giannis would feel about him, and I think therefore the odds seem to be strongly tilting toward this idea that Giannis is not going to be leaving the Bucks. Maybe he doesn't sign the Supermax right away, but why would he? He can get through this entire year and see how it plays out. But if I had a guess, I think that this is another sign that he's going to be there to stay long term.
Yeah, I just don't see it. I never really did, just because he seems, you know, a little bit, in terms of the way he's wired, maybe a little bit different than other stars. And it does seem like there's quite a bit of loyalty there in Milwaukee. And he has obviously quite a connection to the franchise and the city. And I agree with you. I do think ultimately he does re-sign there, but I guess, you know, if he does decide to put it off and they don't have the success in the regular season or certainly in the playoffs that it would be anticipated, like, do you think that that changes the perspective? Like, if they don't make it to the finals, is it still on the table that he leaves, or do you ultimately think that, you know, this level of dedication to improving the roster will convince him to take that extra money and just, you know, stay in the place that he's only known?
Well, I don't think any of these things are mutually exclusive or binary. So, I mean, because of how this past season's operated, what the Bucks have done with the roster, I don't think it's going to get to the point that they collapse and don't get to where they're expected. But that being said, everything in the NBA is fluid. So turn of events, surprises, surely they could influence, you know, a decision one way or the other. And until someone puts pen to paper, like, nothing is ever guaranteed in the NBA. But when I'm just looking at the tea leaves here and just knowing how Giannis ticks and where the Bucks are headed this season, I don't think you're going to see this monumental collapse. Now, does that mean they'll win the NBA title? Not necessarily, but I think that, you know, the idea of what's better for Giannis, I think it'll still point to staying with Milwaukee long term.
Looking at the Heat, the team that beat them, the moves that they've made, you know, the draft pick of Achiuwa from Memphis got rave reviews. They bring in Bradley. They do lose Crowder, but they also bring in Harkless. Are they still, in your eyes, the team to beat heading into the season in the Eastern Conference?
Yeah, I would also add Goran Dragic coming back.
Yes.
I would still put Milwaukee because of Giannis, and I think that, in fairness to the Bucks, he'll probably be healthier. I think the fact that, you know, they've gone through two straight playoff flameouts, that's going to lead to different adjustments as far as mindset and how rotations are. But yeah, I think that you could make a case for Miami being number one or at least number two. And what Miami's done is they've banked on the continuity, you know, the character as far as familiar faces and new faces of what makes up those guys. And they're all chippy, they're overachievers, they're well-conditioned. But they've also accumulated assets to be in striking distance for, heaven forbid, Giannis is available or anyone else. I really like how Miami has been able to thread this needle where their fortunes do not necessarily lie on what they make in future moves, but they're putting themselves in a position to be able to do so because of what assets they have with their roster. But in the meantime, they can perfectly lean on what they have to win games.
Last one before I let you go is close to here in Toronto. The Raptors bring back Van Vliet on the four-year deal, but Ibaka, like we said, is gone, and it seems more likely than not that Gasol is gone. And for a team that vastly exceeded expectations this past season, you look at their roster, where do you kind of land on them? Are they in that second tier in the Eastern Conference?
Yeah, I never want to count them out, but yeah, they've gone through a lot of challenges. They had to take care of Fred VanVleet because he's been an overachieving guy. He's a young guy, and he's something that you can at least bank on amidst all the uncertainty, but there's a lot of question marks to fill, not just how do they fill Serge Ibaka's departure, Marc Gasol possibly leaving, but Kyle Lowry. I mean, he's, you know, getting up there in age. He's on the final year of the deal. I know the Raptors fans love him, and he's very valuable for what he does. But do they ever get into a fork in the road where they think, hey, to be able to keep this train moving, do we trade him because he's an attractive expiring contract that can get us assets in the form of draft picks or young talent? Or do we continue to lean on Kyle because of his amazing defense, his amazing leadership, and the way that he really sets the tone with the team's culture? It's some tough decisions to make, but, you know, I think Bobby Webster's really good at his job. Simon Ujiri, same thing, and Nick Nurse as well with what he gets out of the players. So, yes, they might be a notch below Milwaukee and Miami, but they're always going to still be a team they have to worry about that can overachieve because they have so much good culture and pieces that can, you know, get them through the transition of losing other valuable pieces.